like a live trip when it's in the
You can interact with the speakers at the bottom of that playlist, the playlist, and type in your questions. So I think I'm hearing some unmuting of the call. Is Levi available?
I'm here.
Okay, great. How about Sammy?
Yeah, I'm here too.
Awesome. Sorry about the confusion. We had a little trouble with the Blog Talk Radio platform this morning, so we had to wait for it to get back online. So hope that didn't hold anybody up, but I'm just giving a quick explainer about the coolest hacks. I hope everybody heard that okay. I thought what I wanted to do, too, is I'm going to talk about some of the ones I wrote about, but not all of them. I also wanted to get Levi and Sammy to kind of give their take on any that I didn't cover. They'd like to sort of point out. But I'm going to kind of run through some of the ones I thought were the most interesting ones. And I guess since we don't know your voices yet, Levi, if you don't mind answering first and then Sammy goes second so we know who's talking, that would be great. So the first one that kind of caught the eye, it was a little bit controversial too, and I want to get into that as well, but it was the mousejack attack that researchers at Bastille discovered and sort of created. They basically set up they found a vulnerability where they set up an attack against non-Bluetooth wireless mice. They used a $15 dongle that basically sniffs traffic from PCs and Macs and Linux machines, and they were exploiting the unencrypted communications used by several wireless dongle vendors. And there were some pretty big names, Logitech, Dell, HP, Lenovo, Microsoft, Gigabyte, and Amazon Basics. It was basically taking advantage of those communications between the wireless mouse and its dongle so that the attacker could then spoof a mouse and insert his own clicks and inputs and even generate keystrokes on the victim's computer. I think the distance was 100 meters, so it had to be in certain physical proximity. So I wanted to kind of, this one seemed a little painfully obvious to me, but also it was interesting that I hadn't really been illuminated before as far as I know. So I wanted to ask you guys what you thought about this one in particular. It did get mixed reviews in the industry, I would say. Some people kind of made fun of it, and some people thought it was interesting. So I'm going to start with you, Levi, and see what you thought about it.
So I thought it was super interesting. When I look at the hacks in 2016, I kind of rate them by feasibility and practicality, but also impact. And I think mousejack has the potential for a lot of impact. And sometimes the best hacks are the simple ones, and it doesn't have to be overly complicated to be, you know, an interesting hack. And I think, you know, this was a clever hack in that the authors were sort of, you know, contemplating at some point these wireless mice and the dongles that we use sometimes. And yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, 100 meters, I mean, Usain Bolt is the fastest man in the world. He runs 100 meters in slightly less than 10 seconds. So you're talking 10 seconds, you know, for the fastest man in the world. That's some distance. That's some range. So I think if you're in, you know, somewhat physical proximity, you're in the building, there's definitely potential to at least achieve some mischief with this, if not some actual malicious activity. So I thought it was a pretty interesting hack.
And it also shows that people still do use mice, including me.
Absolutely.
Sammy, what do you think about it? What did you think about it?
Yeah, I agree with Levi. I think it's pretty cool. I'd say one of the interesting things about this attack is that it also works on encrypted devices. So we have Logitech, which actually is supposed to use AES for things. You'd assume that there's a higher level of security there, and they were able to still take control. And, you know, people have done all sorts of attacks just using a mouse. I mean, you can kind of have full access to a system. And they were doing, you know, they were injecting keystrokes. I think that by itself is pretty awesome. And the fact that it could happen on a lot of these devices, I think what's really kind of scary is that most of these devices are not upgradable. I think the only one that has some sort of firmware upgrade was the Logitech, and everything else had baked-in firmware that was not upgradable in any way, literally the PCB inside just had no way to expose the upgrade pins, and you're kind of just stuck with these exploitable keyboards and mice.
That's exactly what I was just going to ask you about, do these things, can they ever really get fixed? Because like you said, some of these are end-of-life devices that don't get updates, or they're older, right, and they're still out there being used by people. So I thought that was another thing that was kind of, to me, one of the more lesser discussed elements of this was the fact that some of the stuff just isn't getting fixed. It's just going to stay like that, which I guess is kind of a theme we see with IoT stuff anyway, but that definitely struck me too.
Yeah.
So the other one I
enjoyed that.
The other one I wanted to look at was this one. We didn't actually write about this one, but we did talk about it in other stories. But at Black Hat USA, there was a light bulb worm research presented by Colin O'Flynn. Basically, he was showing that you could take one smart light bulb rigged with a worm and spread it to nearby lights within minutes. So his concept was you could show how a worm could be unleashed in a city with smart lighting or in a local area, either to turn on or off the lights or to perform a DDoS attack, that kind of thing. He focused specifically on the Philips Hue smart lighting system to sort of demonstrate this. I thought that was really interesting because, you know, we think a lot about the kinetic element of attacks that can happen, and that's everyone's obviously biggest fear. So this one kind of seemed to play on our biggest fears about IoT security, even though in a way it was sort of had its funny side to it too. It was just a light bulb, but the fact that he was able to prove that was doable, I thought was really interesting. So I wanted to kind of see what you thought about that first, Levi. I don't know if you actually saw that presentation, but I thought that was a really interesting one.
Yeah, I think it's super interesting, primarily because it's not malicious in nature per se, as far as the effect that it can achieve. But you can imagine just in a household that is using these smart light bulbs and the lights all go out, you know, you can imagine that someone is flipping the breakers off and on, off and on, off and on, and not understanding, you know, what causation is for the outage. And then you call the electrician, he comes out and he's scratching his head or her head because they just, you know, they haven't necessarily, you know, thought about that next layer and smart light bulbs. So again, I just think in terms of mischief, it's very clever, and you know, I wouldn't want to be the recipient of it, of course, but certainly very clever.
Yeah, I'd also say it's pretty interesting. I think it's obviously if you can start attacking. I mean, obviously we've all seen IoT attacks and distributed denial of services, but if you can actually write a malicious worm and infect all of these devices, and then in the future if you can find, let's say, a new vulnerability that allows you to hop from, let's say, the Zigbee light bulb onto a consumer's device, because often there's a bridge, right? Often there's like a Zigbee to wireless bridge that actually allows you to interact with your lights. So for example, with Hue, you'll have a base station that'll have both Wi-Fi and Zigbee, and then that will communicate with the rest of the Zigbee devices. But if you can infect that, and then you can bridge over Wi-Fi to other Wi-Fi-based devices, then, you know, if you can actually have a mesh network across a town or something, and you can just jump onto sort of anyone's Wi-Fi and start performing attacks, I mean, that would just be sort of it seems like the next obvious step of taking this, and that could be scary.
Yeah, and just to add to what you were saying, Sammy, the attack was exploiting a vulnerability in a piece of the, I think it's a touch link element of the Zigbee late link protocol, I think it was called. So there was a vulnerability in the actual protocol, the communications protocol that he was playing around with, and I guess they did some sort of a side channel attack that actually even was able to override like new firmware updates, so they could inject their own firmware with the worm into the system. So it was pretty complicated, really. It sounded so simple, a light bulb worm, but there were a lot of pieces here. But I guess that leads to my next question that I wanted to ask you guys, of how realistic you this type of attack would be. Because that's one of the things we, you know, think about a lot with IoT stuff. It's their IoT vulnerabilities are, you know, basically a dime a dozen, right? They're easy to find in a lot of cases. But the reality of the actual attack or the risk factor, you know, are these things that really would happen, or that they really people should be concerned about? So I wanted to get your thoughts on the sort of reality piece of it, I guess.
Well, I think if you look at what's happened over the last 6 months with Mirai and some of the derivatives, enormous botnets doing enormous damage with denial of service attacks, there is an enormous amount of scanning out on the internet looking for IoT devices, like you said, Kelly. I think this is absolutely something that falls into the practical realm. If attackers can find these devices, especially at scale, you better believe they're going to be looking for them. And, you know, they're going to be looking for specific signatures on specific ports to try and take advantage of these types of devices. And we've absolutely seen that over the last 6 months.
Yeah, and I think in addition to some of those DDoS attacks, we're going to see some, we're probably not going to hear about all of them. We're probably not even going to know about a lot of them, but a lot of these devices are, let's say, their IP cameras. So someone might put it on the DMZ and make it accessible so they can see what's happening in their, you know, office remotely. But networks like Mirai take over, or if you can connect to one of these, and most of these have SSH running, and that's how a lot of them got essentially Mirai installed. If you can SSH into those, that also means you now have access to the local network. And from there, essentially it's as if you installed your own little sort of backdoor machine inside someone's office network or corporate network or home network. And from there, you can actually do a number of attacks internally on the network. You can start ARP spoofing, you can start DNS spoofing, you can start sniffing traffic from anyone else on the network. So from there, depending on the let's say company it is, you can then do, you know, you can start stealing information, you can start exfiltrating data, you can start infecting other machines. And I think that's where, you know, more than, you know, all the DDoS, of course, is super damaging, you can do a lot more.
That's a really good point, because I think people forget about that, you know, and they make jokes about the refrigerator getting hacked or their toaster getting hacked, but the idea of jumping from one of those devices to a network to, you know, say a person working at home or, you know, connected to their corporate network, it could be complicated, or they're just their own personal information. So I think that's something, or in a company that has some of these devices, like they have smart lighting. So I think you're right. That's something that kind of gets forgotten. I think everybody got excited about the Mirai DDoS, but the other more escalated type attacks are kind of scary. So I have to ask you, do you guys have smart lighting in your homes or your offices? are you worried about it?
I do not have smart lighting, and I hope Recorded Future does not either. I don't think they do, but I'm definitely waiting for the security awareness in interior lighting to take effect before I start adopting these type of light bulbs.
I'm looking around my place. I don't know. I think I have one, but it's not Wi-Fi connected, so it doesn't actually bridge anything else. I got it for testing. I probably have a couple IoT devices, but none of them are connected. I think I'm more interested in just taking a look at their security.
Yeah, that's probably the way to do it. I can't imagine anybody trying to hack you anyway, Sammy. You would just, you know, they couldn't even do it. So
I'm sure people can.
So I'm going to switch gears a little bit because there was kind of a cool contest this summer at DEF CON that I thought was really interesting. And it was the DARPA Cyber Grand Challenge, which basically was an all-machine capture the flag contest. So, you know, we're used to seeing at DEF CON individual hackers or hacker teams, you know, sort of manually hacking together, trying to break into things and get through the contest network and their opponents. But this time, the machines did all the work. So the teams of researchers brought their own autonomous computer systems, and they had them, you know, go take on all these test bed of challenges, as well as hacking their opponents' machines, and even finding and fixing security flaws on that network, as well as fixing some on their own systems as they went along. So it was really interesting. I didn't get to watch it. One of our reporters went. But I've been reading a lot about it and talked to some folks, and it was really interesting. I thought a really interesting concept, and it made you think a little bit about, you know, what the future was here. So one of the things I know, there was a machine, which I think they were talking about the amounts of stuff they found. So like 6 of the 7 machines were able to find a SQL Slammer flaw and patch it on the contest network, and then some did the same with Heartbleed all within a matter of minutes. So the patching was quick, the detection was quick. It really kind of made you think. It was kind of creepy, but a cool type of contest. And it made you think about the future of security and hacking. So I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on the significance of this contest. I don't know if you guys actually saw it at DEF CON, but I'd love to get your thoughts on what you thought about this concept of the autonomous machines doing the hacking.
Say hello to your robot overlords. Good. <Leave that.
laughs> No, I was just going to say that I think artificial intelligence is incredibly cool, and there's so many applications in security. I don't think we're quite there yet, I think there's still a lot of work to be done, but this is just one fantastic example of some of the progress that's been made. And like you said, patching SQL Slammer and you know, patching Heartbleed, I don't know if that was, you know, sort of pre-programmed into, you know, an index of things to look for, if that was sort of learned behavior. But, you know, where it's really exciting is where, you know, you have algorithms that can learn and adapt and do that sort of, you know, on the fly. And that's super exciting in security.
Yeah, it's a combination of scare, you know, scary and exciting. I think the fact that it is a little scary is also kind of exciting to me. I'm definitely, you know, every day you see someone like Amazon or Google or Microsoft releasing some new updates to their machine learning systems, their algorithms, and then making a ton of this available, which I love. There's a lot of pretty cool open source toolkits that you can use in a variety of ways. So I'm really interested to see once people start finding more effective ways of applying these machine learning algorithms to essentially exploit discovery, exploit development, and execution. I think that will be super interesting. But at the same time, it's going to be pretty scary because now we're talking about, you know, a couple of people who figured that out and who cracked that net first will also have essentially zero-day exploits into a ton of software, hardware, firmware. And the question is, who will find that first?
Yep.
Will they tell anyone, right? Are they going to sell that? Who do they sell that to? What happens then?
Yeah, I'm picturing like the coolest hacks 10 years from now being all machine names and not hacker names. A little scary.
Sam is absolutely right about the machine learning algorithms being open sourced, and that if people, you know, really study them from an attacker perspective, you know, and they find the weaknesses in those machine learning algorithms, to Sammy's point, I mean, they're really going to be ahead of the game, and that's super scary.
So I want to circle back to Mirai for a minute, because there was kind of a cool project and very controversial project that came out after that, and it was kind of dubbed a vigilante worm. Leo Linsky, a researcher from PacketFlood, came up with this worm that would go out and infect and fix weak IoT passwords and IoT devices. He basically called it an anti-worm worm, and the idea was for proof of concept for academic purposes, but he did publish the POC on GitHub, and there were some concerns it would be abused or might fail and cause more issues, but it really did kind of get people talking a lot about, you know, the absurdity of the fact that these things have default credentials and people don't know it or just don't bother to change the passwords, and how vulnerable that makes it, obviously, after the Mirai incident. So, you know, I know this was, you know, probably an eye-opening way to do it, but I wanted to see what you guys thought about this project and maybe if it opened up some discussion about how to be more proactive in terms of locking down these devices.
I was just going to say, like, I kind of like the – I do like the vigilante stuff. I think it kind of reminds me of, like, there was a Windows worm a long time ago. I think it was, like, Blaster or that I Love You virus or one of those. And someone else had actually released a virus that went around and just patched everyone. I thought that was great. This is a little different because, you know, you brought up the point that it could actually – disable, it actually might prevent your machine from working properly or your IoT device from working properly. But I'm not sure if that's worse than an actual attacker having compromised that machine or device.
Yeah, I think I have to disagree a little bit. I mean, I think it's emotionally very satisfying to see someone do this and you sort of cheer them on, but it sets kind of a dangerous precedent because, you know, if a lot of folks get the idea that, you know, they're going to release their own sort of remediation, you know, patch to forcefully do this stuff, obviously we can run into problems pretty quickly. And, you know, the industry's been talking about this for well over a decade, especially to the examples that Sammy gave. You know, a lot of folks were advocating for doing that, but it still seems like a dangerous precedent to make that sort of legal under U.S. law anyway.
I see what you're saying, although I wouldn't necessarily say just because one person does it, it makes it okay for someone else. I don't personally believe that just because that if someone else sets the precedent, then I can irresponsibly go and do something that's similar. I think sort of everyone needs to make their own decisions for themselves. But I do see that happening. I mean, I think you're totally right in what would actually happen. So I see you there.
It would be kind of cool go ahead.
No, sorry, Kelly, go ahead.
I was just going to be kind of cool if a company could build their own tool for their own IoT devices internally that would do that, you know, just to automate it. I don't know how it would not get sort of out of hand, but that would be an interesting idea. It seems like that would be a nice tool to have if you used it the right way or if it was managed or, you know, sort of compartmentalized in a way.
Yeah, they could just solve it just by not having default passwords on these things when they sell them, and this whole thing would be moot.
Yeah, true. So the other project I want to talk to, I'm going to let Sammy take this one, the lead on this one. We wrote about this year, wasn't too long ago, a few months ago, a project called PoisonTap, a tool that basically hacks locked Windows and Mac machines that are locked down with their password. And I think it was a $5 total that you spent on it, from what I remember, Sammy. I'll let you tell us a bit about this attack and kind of what inspired it. I thought it was really interesting.
Thanks. This was using a $5 Raspberry Pi Zero. I chose that because it's inexpensive, kind of in the maker community, and I'm also sort of a fan of getting other people into coding and hardware. And I don't know, for probably the last year or so, I've just been thinking in the back of my head, it would be very, I created a simple tool some years ago that basically, if you had a machine that was unlocked, that was not password protected, you could just plug in a device and in about 5 seconds, it would install a backdoor, change your DNS settings, evade your firewall, do a bunch of other things. But the computer was already unlocked, so it's like you could have effectively done that yourself. This just made it a little more subtle. And it kind of demonstrated, okay, you should always lock your computer. And then since then, I've been thinking, man, I wonder if there's anything you can do when your computer is locked. So I think it's just been in the back of my head for the past year or so. And one day I realized, oh, maybe you can still have access to the network. Because I know when I lock my computer, if I'm downloading something and then, let's say, I unlock it an hour later, that download is completed. So clearly the networking is still going on. And
right.
At the same time, you can add a network device. You know, you can plug and play network devices. So you can plug a Ethernet to USB dongle into the machine. Well, what if I did that, but it's not really Ethernet to USB? What if it's really just a hardware device emulating that? And then can I then start taking over network traffic? And through sort of a series of vulnerabilities, I was able to begin taking over all internet traffic. And then from there, you can do all sorts of fun things like siphoning cookies. So it just, you know, created an iframe for the top million websites and downloaded all the users' cookies, installed backdoors, web-based backdoors in web cache, and kind of evaded some other web security mechanisms through that. So, yeah, it was a fun tool.
Sorry, Levi, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut in. I was just going to ask Sammy a question. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I didn't say anything.
That was still me.
Yeah, so much. I guess I was just going to finish off. It's kind of the whole point is to really demonstrate, you know, in a corporate environment, I know when I go into offices, a lot of people are under the assumption that, okay, if your computer is locked, password protected, then you are secure and you have nothing to worry about. You know, if someone sort of walks in the office, uses the bathroom or something, plugs something in for a minute, this kind of evades that notion of security.
Is there any way to sort of defend against this type of an attack? I think you talked a little bit about if you were doing like HTTPS stuff, you'd be fine. But are there other ways, like for the non-encrypted stuff, to protect yourself?
Microsoft's response was to not leave your laptop or desktop unattended. But there is so there was actually a recent project that came out that I saw. I believe it's called BeamGun, and it's specifically to stop these sorts of attacks. So I think just a developer out there saw these sorts of attacks happening and created some software that I believe it prevents your USB, it's only for Windows, but it prevents rogue USB devices from operating. So I think that's pretty cool. And then on OS, on Mac OS, I haven't seen any way to really prevent this. I mean, even in my administrator account where I require a password for everything, I did find one way that you can prevent it, and if you use File Vault. So if you do full disk encryption, you can enable sleep or hibernate, and then there's some settings that you can put in a terminal that will, whenever you go into sleep mode, it removes your keys, your essentially hard drive encryption keys from memory, at which point when you come back, even if you turn the computer on, nothing's decrypted in memory, so it can't actually, you can't communicate with the browser or network.
Okay. And Levi, did you have any comments or questions about that project with Sammy? I meant to let you weigh in there. I'm sorry.
No, it's a super, super cool. One of the questions I had was, there was a lot of talk about, you know, passive information gathering, but I was curious if you can also do active man-in-the-middle attacks. So things like redirecting, name server queries to, a name server that you control or something like that.
That's a good question. Technically, you can. So the Raspberry Pi itself doesn't provide internet. So when you're actually moving all of that, you're moving all of the internet traffic from their primary network device to the Raspberry Pi. You could add a GSM chip and then essentially turn that into a man-in-the-middle device, where that you can also communicate with the real server yourself and still allow them to kind of sitting in the middle there. I guess that, I hadn't thought about that. That could be really interesting if you actually stick it in, let's say, a desktop. They might not notice that it's just, you just have a sort of extra USB dongle on there, and then you're now actively man in the middle lane. And it does do DNS spoofing, Levi. So, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Nice. I think we need to do that. That sounds super slick to me. Plenty of applications there. And I just have to say, that it wasn't on this year's list. It was 2015. But if you haven't seen Sammy's motorized combo breaker video, that has to take the cake as one of the coolest hacks of all time.
Thanks. Kelly, I have to ask you, how do you choose us two in particular?
Well, it's hard because I'm just going to let you guys add to the list here. We're not going over all the ones I wrote about this year. I just try to pick the ones that kind of stood out, that we thought were the most, different, or, sometimes they're funny, sometimes they're just bizarre, sometimes they're just really kind of game changers. So it really depends. It's hard. It's impossible to have a comprehensive list because we try to cover as much stuff as we can. So I'm sure I missed several. So I was going to actually ask you guys if there are any that you would point out from this year that you would have put on a list for coolest hacks.
Well, I was also curious, how did you choose Levi and myself to join the show?
Well, I chose you because you made the list, and I wanted to hear about the poison tap from you. And I know I've known Levi as a super smart researcher and with really good insight on all these kind of things, so I thought he'd be a really good expert to talk about this. So that's why.
I agree.
I'd love to hear if you guys know of any other things that you saw this year that we didn't talk about that you would say, hey, you guys should check this one out. I know there was one you mentioned, Levi, but that was 2015, right? The one you were talking about.
Yeah, it sort of disqualifies, but I do think it's if you haven't seen the video, it's really worth checking that out on YouTube. Sammy shows the math and everything.
The problem is Sammy's had a lot of good ones over the last couple of years, so it's hard to get them all into one.
I know it.
I do like Charlie Miller and Chris Alsex. They sort of took their previous GPAC and made it even more really just scary.
The car, you're talking about the Jeep, the can stuff they did this year? Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't go over that now because I feel like car hacking has almost become sort of, everyone's so used to hearing about it. But I think you're right. I mean, they did this year, they did it actually more locally in terms of taking over the CAN bus, but they did it at high speeds, whereas before they were doing at 10 miles an hour or 5 miles an hour. This time they did it at 60 miles an hour. They could take over the brakes and the different wheel the wheels to turn, things like that. So that was you definitely sort of put an exclamation point on all the work they've done on the GPAC. I thought that was definitely on my story this year. We just didn't go over it today because I figured everybody's heard so much about car hacking. So
yeah,
I thought that was pretty cool too.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it's one of the very few attacks that we're talking going from something that's typically entirely digital to actually harming human beings. So that's the really, really scary part, right? They turn the steering wheel at 60 miles per hour, a full 90 degrees, and that means that someone else could do that.
Yeah.
So I think it's terrifying. It's actually terrifying. The fact that they did it remotely, you know, the year before, obviously
right.
not at those speeds, but the fact that they were able to, you know, disengage certain parts of the car and make it difficult to drive or stop. It's pretty horrifying.
Yeah, so I think that one would make, like, the scariest, coolest hack of 2016
when it comes
down to it. But, I just wanted to mention we're kind of out of our on-air time right now, and we're going to go over to our online chat. But before we do that, I just wanted to see if either of you guys had anything else you wanted to mention. And then I also want to thank you both for taking time to talk to us today. And for everyone's patience with our technical difficulties at the top of the hour, which luckily resolved just in time. But I wanted to see if either Levi or Sammy had any last comments before we jump over to the chat.
Just thanks so much for the opportunity, Kelly. It's been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, it was great having the two of you here again. Levi Gunder and Sammy Kimkar, two really smart and cool researchers who we're really lucky to have today. So thank you. So with that, we're going to end the audio broadcast. But if you could stick around and join us on the text chat under your audio player, we can go from there. Thanks again for being part of Dark Reading Radio, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks.